Welcome to this Albion Raw podcast special. My name's Alan Wares. I'm joined in the studio today by Liz Costa, Vice Chair of the Brighton and Hove Albion Supporters Club, and she's coming to the studio to talk about her good friend Sarah Watts, who tragically passed away last week. Liz, welcome to the Raw.
Thanks,
welcome
Alan.
To Reverb. Perhaps I can start with, where did you first meet Sarah?
In the church hall, which is now, I believe, a gymnastics club, at the back of the Goldstone, where we used to have to go in with umbrellas because the roof leaked.
That's the one on the corner of
on
the
Newtown Road,
the bottom end of Goldstone Lane.
That's it.
Of all things, that's actually that survived there. That's probably just about the last thing. The houses on the Goldstone Lane, and that's it.
That's it. Yeah.
So, absolutely. What year do you think you were talking about?
1983.
Because actually, we've had you on the Raw before, and that's kind of when you said you started supporting the Albion with a husband that you didn't care for too
absolutely.
Much at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, he didn't care for me an awful lot either.
Right.
So it was my escape route, and I found that it was great. I remember the first game I went on, and I think I actually sat with Sarah on the coach going to Portsmouth for that dreadful pouring with rain day, 5-0, which they then proceeded to replay from their local radio station over the tannoy while we were kept standing in the pouring rain before they let us out.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
So obviously Sarah was part of the Albion sort of fandom at the time anyway. You came and found her almost?
Pretty much, yeah. She was already there. Her sister Mandy had taken her regularly to games.
Mm-hmm.
She was sort of in her late teens at that time, and I decided it would be an escape that I could successfully get away from, because my stepson was an Albion fan,
mm-hmm.
so he never let on, because he kept on to his father that he didn't know where I'd gone. He thought I'd gone shopping, you know. The fact that he was with me was irrelevant.
So what were your early memories of Sarah?
I can't actually remember too much at the time. I mean, we were just football fans, and I was just lapping up the sort of camaraderie that there was amongst fans at the time. And I very quickly began to realise that, thankfully, it was one place I could go as a woman on my own,
mm-hmm.
and meet up with fellow-minded fans. And that basically was where it all started.
So you're talking about Sarah in her teens. I mean, if we kind of sort of jump to now compared to, you know, obviously to then, did the Sarah that we know, you know, we came to know, Was she that person at the time?
She was a very kind person, but she was also a bit feisty. If things upset her, you knew about it. But then that was
that
the redhead
change.
In her. That was the redhead in her, which...
Have you got an early example?
Well, I think the main example that probably a lot of Albion fans will remember was at Walsall. That's the one that really stands out. Other things, they were just niggles, really.
Sure.
But
she never let a niggle pass her by.
Oh, goodness, no. And why should she? You know.
Well, absolutely. So if you were starting, you know, your Albion fandom in 83 and Sarah was already there, how did you sort of get closer?
I think we just morphed.
Yeah.
It was one of those things that you just sit and talk to people and you realise you've got probably absolutely nothing but an awful lot in common.
For instance,
apart from anything else, she was 20 years younger than me, which, of course, you know, at that time was quite a lot.
Well,
she
was, if you're going to put it that way, you would have been
she
sorry
was
twice
the same
her
sort
age.
Of age. Well, yeah, I was.
Yeah.
She was the same age as my kids. My son is 6 months younger than she would have been next week. My daughter is 6 months older. So, you know, she was the same age as my kids. But we all, as football fans, were able to converse on an equal keel, which is what it should be.
And was she a member of the Supporters Club at the time?
Oh, yes.
Was that
yes.
something that you immediately signed up to?
I did. As soon as I knew there was something I could join, which was away from home and away from my stepchildren and away from my ex-husband.
It's away from the ex-husband bit, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
She provided refuge.
She did. And the fact that I was going to meet with girls,
mm-hmm.
rather than some strange boy that he would have got upset about, it did help.
Mm.
And then, of course, we used to travel regularly to the lottery draws every Monday night that the club ran.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was when we got a close-knit few of us who, well, like groupies, we went everywhere.
Mm.
And there were a lot of women involved, which I suppose is not unnatural at that time. With,
sure.
You know, you've got youngsters and players and that sort of thing. But that was when we got to know a lot of the players at that time very, very well. They became good friends, Terry Connor being one.
I was about to say, Terry Connor is one of those that a lot of people, and I find this you know, unfair on, you know, the teasing, the amount of teasing there was of Sarah. Terry Connor is one of those that's kind of associated with Sarah. And
well, she babysat for him for a while.
Mm-hmm.
When Janet's first child was born, and I think they lived in Shoreham, she used to go babysit for them.
Mm.
So she naturally became friendly, and we all did, because that was Terry. He was very outgoing, and of course they used to, the players were in twos all the time at all these lottery draws.
Mm.
And it was pretty much the same two every that were together each time. Terry was quite often with Jimmy Case, but he was more often with Danny Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Terry then paired up with Eric Young, and there was Kieran O'Regan and...
Gary Howlett,
yeah. Okay, it was Gary Howlett and Kieran O'Regan.
Sure.
Then, you know, that's how we actually got to know them, because we were always there and the players recognised us, so they would always come and chat to us.
Mm. And obviously Sarah was trustworthy enough, you know, that Terry Connor was happy to
Yes, and he, bless him, actually came to visit her with his wife in the hospital when she first got to Worthing Hospital, and it kept her going for days. It was lovely. I mean, just to see the look of, you know, it really did lift her. It lifted all of us, including her sisters, because they saw the change in her.
Sure. So if you get the first 10 years, I mean, in your first 10 years of knowing Sarah from 83, and
it wasn't the deep friendship that it became, because then things started going wrong at the club.
Well, this is what I was just getting onto. I mean, your first 10 years is getting to know the players and getting a friendship going with them, and it kind of sounds like a fairly, on a certain level, a fairly reciprocal friendship.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the club, you know, went to the High Court. There was the planning application for on the Goldstone ground, and then there was the extraordinary general meeting, and then various things, and horrible hit the fan.
Absolutely.
I guess that's when you had to galvanise.
Well, the supporters club then had to sit and say, what do we do? Because we were being constantly accused of being in the club's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't understand that we were totally independent of the club.
Mm.
And although Ron Pavey, who was the club secretary at the time, was very much with us, and he gave us the use of rooms for meetings and things if we needed them, and for functions, mm-hmm. you know, Christmas parties and this sort of thing, we were not anything to do with the football club.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to be very, very careful that we didn't step on toes, otherwise a lot of what we were being offered by Ron would have been withdrawn. So much so that when the election for when the Lib Dems wanted a new councillor,
mm-hmm.
you know, the county council elections were coming up, Sarah wrote to the local party chairman. And
this
said,
is over in Eastbourne, isn't
it?
Yeah.
But I think, I seem to remember the party chairman was actually somewhere over this side of the county.
Okay. Right.
And she wrote him a very lengthy letter and basically saying what he'd done and why it was absolutely vital that he was not selected. As a result of that, she got a letter from a solicitor,
mm-hmm.
which we all know, pretty much guaranteed know now, that it was all a spoof.
Mm-hmm.
They were the Brighton Three. There was the guy from, who was then, it was Plan Ahead, I think, the company that did a lot of the printing for the,
mm-hmm.
and Roy Shooter, of course, bless him, and Sarah. They were the three that got these letters.
So did Sarah get the same letter that
Roy
got?
Oh, yes, yeah. And you've seen what Roy did to his
one. I was about to say, we never saw Sarah's reply.
Well, we
happy
we
to
actually
put a name to Roy's, I guess.
Well, we actually then employed a very eminent QC to have a look at the letters and to see whether there was anything we could do.
Mm.
And he was very much of the opinion that perhaps they weren't completely that something was not quite right, because
sure.
No lawyer would have made that many errors.
Well, quite as pointed out by Roy, and is now this letter is on display in the museum.
Yeah.
If I can take you back though very slightly, I mean that was kind of 96-97. If I can take you back to about 93, then there was rumblings of discontent. There was the Brighton Independent Supporters Association was set up. People could see that the club was not heading in the direction
that's
it could
right.
be.
Well, we were being accused, as I say, all the way through that. I mean, John Bain and Peter Kennard and the Gullseye group,
mm-hmm.
they were on one side and we were on the other side. Mm. And very much there were brickbats being thrown both ways the whole time. We couldn't understand their vociferous attitude.
Mm.
And we were being blamed for things that actually were inaccurate. So,
sure. Give us a for instance.
Well, I mean, everything that we did,
mm.
They said that we were doing it because the club had told us to.
Mm.
And because we were basically working for the club, we were not independent at all. At the time, we weren't quite as militant as we became, and were. I was slightly embarrassed by all the tub thumping that we got from the other side.
Now, isn't it interesting you use that word? Now, if Sarah had the opportunity to look back on her life, do you think at any point she'd have ever said, "I'm militant"? You know, this sort of softly.
Not until all this happened.
Mm.
Certainly, she wouldn't have been considered to have been such. I spent yesterday afternoon with her sister, and at no time did I get any impression from her that, yes, she was a naughty girl and they kept escaping from the clutches of their parents, and she was led astray by her older sisters.
All right.
Quite frequently. So she enjoyed the excitement of
breaking
the rules.
Safe.
Breaking the rules, but within safe environment.
Mm.
And it was only when it really did get to the point where something needed to be done. And I suppose really Fans United everybody. It united all the fans groups.
But at the beginning of that, I'm not sure if it was you and Sarah, but it was you were invited into a meeting with David Bellotti and ended up screaming at you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, I was... He actually... it was the day that Ivor Kaplan had produced a leaflet for the council at the time, demonstrating what it was going to cost us to stay for a year, having paid an extra year's rent at the Goldstone, or to go for 1 year, only 1 year, with no future planned, at Portsmouth. And the difference in the sums was quite remarkable.
Mm.
And we were handing them out in the street... And John Back, who was then the safety officer, came and physically grabbed me and took me inside.
What a charmer.
Absolutely. And I was sort of frog marched into Bellotti's office where it was a screaming match. In hindsight, I was laughing quite a bit because I know that he wanted to hit me.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there were two desks.
Didn't you want to hit him?
Oh, yeah. But he'd got in first and I'd have floored him and then he'd have been in court. But there were two desks, unfortunately, and he was sitting... sort of with two desks between us, but you could see he was bristling.
What
and,
a coward.
Oh, yeah. I just wish I was almost invited him. I said, you know, go on, go, do it, do it. And John Back was absolutely wetting himself laughing. He was sitting on his hands because he didn't dare move, but I could feel him beside me. He was laughing
so
much.
About to hold you back?
Well, basically, the banter that was going on, and I think I won. Because he kept, I asked him who the hell he thought he was talking to. And he said, "You're not important to me." I said, "I don't care. But I'm still a customer. Mm. And if this is the way you treat your customers, God help your future." And he sort of splattered a bit. And I was then told, I was asked whether, where I watched the game from and how I got in. And I said, "Well, I get in with a season ticket." "Well, that's been, that you are now banned." So I joined the precious few. I think there were about six or eight of us, which included Paul Samra.
Did it include Sarah?
Not initially.
All right.
No, because we didn't stand. She stood on the north stand. She progressed from where I started standing, which was down behind the dugout. Mm. She progressed with her friends from school and work and everything into the north stand.
Mm.
So he knew me because I'd met him from time to time in the radio station when he was the Lib Dem candidate, councillor, MP, whatever he had.
Snivelling coward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he thought he knew me better and he thought he was going to get one over on me, and of course it didn't work.
So where was Sarah's role in all this? I mean, did she not follow?
She was helping. No, she was helping hand out the leaflet. But
it's interesting that someone only grabbed you, not Sarah.
Well, because I was the one outside his office and he could see me from his office window.
Would you dare to think what would have happened if Sarah was there? Would you, she have joined in?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Comped him?
I think she'd have given him what for.
Mm-hmm.
It was then that he actually manhandled a young lady, an 80-odd-year-old lady on the terrace inside, because she had some of the leaflets in her hand. She was just putting them in her handbag. She had been told not to hand them out inside the ground, which was the rules we gave everybody. But unfortunately, he saw them, and he went and he physically tried to shake the information out of her, demanding to know who she was. And eventually, she said, "Minnie Mouse." And he backed off because somebody actually did stand, you know, come and sort of push him off her, basically.
It's amazing.
He was dangerous.
So around this time, I guess that what was happening was there was yourself. Have you ever been the chair of the Supporters Club?
No, I've, for some reason, I've always been chairman of Vice.
So around this time then, with Bellotti manhandling and screaming and what have you, and yourself as in the role of, you know, the vice chair of the Supporters Club, but you know, quite often the voice piece as well. How was Sarah getting more and more involved in this? Because you said earlier that, you know, you were just, I guess, friends who met at the Albion. But, you know, in her role as secretary and yours as vice chair, there must have been an awful lot together that you did in order to you know, have this campaign.
Well, the campaign didn't start until a bit later, really. We used to travel on the coach to all the away games. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we travelled by car, but in most cases it was on the back seat of the coach in the days when one could drink on a coach.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you?
Oh, is the Pope a Catholic?
Sorry. This is the thing, isn't it? Everyone sees Sarah as that good girl.
Yeah.
You know, sort of.
Absolutely.
And yet
she was...
Are you going to use the word raver?
Could do.
Go on then.
If roused, you had to, you know, watch out, basically.
All right. So when we've had those sort of flashed eyes, and I've been on the receiving end of them, when she's had a couple, they're sort of more likely to come out these
words days. Flow a lot easier.
All right. Okay.
As you probably know, she was deeply religious, which really started about 15 years ago when her mum died.
Okay.
But there was another side to her, and I think she tried to keep the two separate. I mean, if anybody said, Jesus Christ, she would get very upset and would make some comment, yes, of course he's here, and this sort of thing, which sometimes upset a few people because they didn't intend to offend.
Mm. It's just a natural sort of outburst,
it's a sort of an everyday thing which most of us took no real notice of it. So we all tried to... curb our language, if you like. Mm. But there were an awful lot of times where religion went out the window.
Football is the religion, isn't it?
Well,
surely.
Precisely, yeah. Well, part of
she
her
was
eulogy,
a mistress to two religions, wasn't she?
Yes, know? Yeah. Well, football, friends, family,
yeah,
and other things, yeah.
So to what extent? Now, like I say, there was a whole load of campaigns going along the time. I think you're probably right that for the fact that from when the Golsden sale was announced in 95 to when we finally left there in 97. I think that it really kicked in around 96, and I think there was the introduction of Dick Knight to the fans. But there was an awful lot in that first season, certainly towards the end of the first season, of those two seasons, of protests and what have you. But by that time, the BISA and everyone, as well as the supporters club, had got together.
Well, the first thing, of course, was Ian Hart called a meeting at Chapman's Hotel in Worthing, which we all went to. Roy was there, and I think it was televised. I think BBC South were there.
Okay.
And that is when all the various groups just sort of decided that there was we needed a bit of a truce here. If we want to win this, we've got to do it together. And that was where it all started.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, it was basically save the Albion, regardless of what your beliefs, credences were.
No matter how you supported the Albion, whether it was through testosterone or through quiet contemplation.
Or common sense sometimes, because testosterone sometimes does run amok.
Yes, quite.
And you don't get things done if you've riled everybody around you. Oddly enough, I seem to remember when we got the police on side to help with everything, was the Blackburn game, the famous Blackburn game, where there was a sort of semi-riot, and we had these... the whole row of police officers right the way across the pitch.
Mm.
And we thought, this is not the way to do it. And I actually went round to see the
I had completely forgotten about that game.
Yeah,
actually.
that was
we'd lost 3-0 or something.
Yeah,
it was a
shocking show of police testosterone, if you like.
Mm.
And we managed to persuade the police and show them that, in fact, there are better ways of doing it. And that was when we got... All the various groups were involved, and I don't think it was Sarah and me particularly. It was just that we needed to get things done, so let's roll our sleeves up and get it done.
Because what was happening later? It's interesting that you're having the liaisons with the police, because there were pitch invasions later. At times, I did want to watch the Albion. You knew full well that invasions were going to happen, and you knew full well why they were happening. But the police, for the most part, especially after the York City, during the York City game, the police let it play out.
Well, they knew exactly what was going to happen. We already had it planned with them.
Yeah.
I mean, the
so
Mansfield...
these different kinds of riots aren't spontaneous.
The Mansfield game, where we all... the boycott game,
mm-hmm.
because of safety issues, they were afraid that something might happen. So one of the gates in the East Stand was open,
yes.
was basically unlocked.
Yes.
The people outside didn't know, And when they finally did try to force the door open at half time to get in,
found a gay boy quite easily.
The police guy at the time was heard in the box to say, "Would you believe it? They've just broken in." I mean, it was all planned so that nobody got. This was the whole point throughout all the campaigns. Mm. Nobody got hurt.
Mm.
Nobody got arrested. The only one was Simon Valder,
yes.
And that was something he did from his own front room.
Not quite, yes.
But during the actual campaigns,
yeah.
Nobody was hurt, nobody was arrested, and everybody, in hindsight, loved everything, every bit they did.
I remember that gate being forced open, and I think it was actually announced on, we were listening to the commentary outside, I was part of the boycott. And we were listening to the commentary, whoever it was doing it, Radio Sussex, Southern Counties, whatever it was.
Tony Millard at
the time. My goodness me, the gate's been open. Really? Yeah. Leg it round there.
Yeah.
And we watched the second half and we get our 1-1 draw with a Denny Mundy penalty, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
Mansfield join us on the pitch. And actually, I think at the end of the game, we take over the West Stand director's box.
Yeah.
But this
is all the sort of things that were kind of planned on coach trips.
Uh-huh.
Sort of sitting there like the witches around the cauldron trying to work out what we could do and to put... This was the point that everybody pulled ideas.
But the point I want to make here, and I've mentioned it, I mentioned it on the show last week and I mentioned it on Facebook, and I want your take on this, is that an awful lot of this stuff was done, unusually for football fans, by women.
Yeah.
You and Sarah, I say this, you're pioneers in the football supporter movement, not for being the first people to actually invoke any kind of protest or be, you know, a central part of the planning or anything like that. It's just the fact that it's very unusual, maybe even still is now, for women to be at the forefront of the protest movement.
Well, I know Ian Hart did actually refer to me as, he called me Boadicea. So
it's probably the state of your car, really, but...
Quite probably, yeah. You're more than right. But we didn't see anything wrong about it.
No.
Beginning, that was the fact that being able to go to football alone as a woman is totally irrelevant. Because
but once upon a time,
you're a human, you're a football fan, and okay, so some of the guys felt that it was necessary to have a you know, sink half a bar before they did anything.
Mm-hmm.
We just got on and did it, and the fact that the women were there, if you like, doing some of the secretarial duties, which all had to happen to make all of this work.
Mm.
And there, you know, there were times when a calming influence sometimes does work.
Because I want to leap around here a bit, probably, you know, time-wise. I did want to do this chronologically, but leaping around, it was mostly women, if not all women. And I'm going to say, sorry, but sort of second generation, third generation women here who did the protesting outside the Lib Dem conference.
Certainly. There were only two men in that group.
Out of how many?
About a dozen.
Right.
And
just tell people what you did.
Well, there was a banner that was produced which said on it, "If one Lib Dem councillor can ruin a football club, what can a Lib Dem government do for the country?"
Who came up with that? It's brilliant.
I can't remember, but it was another one of these meetings where we came up with... Actually, I'm not so sure it wasn't Sarah.
Right.
Because she was at the time a floating Liberal voter, and it did invoke quite a lot of comment. There were only two. Tim Carter was one of the male members of our group, but by and large, it ranged from Mary Emery and Peggy Thick, who were well into their, you know, older years, shall we say, to a little kiddie in a pushchair who was only months old. And it was because we did it as a group of women that the councillors that were entering the Brighton Centre for their conference came out to talk to us because they were impressed that it wasn't a mouthy lot. These are Lib Dem councillors going into their party conference. And it was the fact that we were there with this banner, which quite clearly was, they could read. His reputation had already gone before him. And they were more than happy to come over and talk to us and ask a bit more information about him and about what he'd been doing. And so that they were... Should we say, on our side?
So they were quite... Well, I was about to say, what was their reaction?
I mean, we didn't get anybody... They were appalled at him and that he was professing to be such, you know, this sort of upright citizen. And we sort of explained to them in words of one syllable, pretty much, exactly what had happened over the preceding couple of years. Because
You made the front pages of the papers, didn't you? Which
unfortunately, yes, it cheesed off the party chairman, because
too bad
he did for his walk along the seafront with waves lapping over his feet with his wife and a dog, I think. Mm-hmm. And we made the front page, and they made page four, which cheesed them off, and it cheesed Bellotti off too, because
That's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Sarah, for all her loveliness and her organisation and her ideas, could be the Rottweiler. You know, you mentioned it very briefly earlier. Tell us what happened in Walsall. Set the scene.
It was the last game of the season.
We're talking 95-96 here, aren't we? Yeah.
The game was actually being sponsored by Bob Emery and the company that he worked for. And he had specially invited people to the lunch, the pre-match lunch. Because of what was happening, we couldn't present our end-of-season trophy to our player of the year on the pitch, largely because I was banned anyway, so I couldn't...
You were banned from everywhere?
I was pretty much... Well, I couldn't go into the ground to present anything on the pitch. And, of course, anything that we did was considered to be somewhat suspect in his eyes. And we were waiting by the player's entrance for the coach to arrive. Unfortunately, Bellotti arrived in a taxi with his wife. Actually, I don't think she was his wife at that time. I think she was still the girlfriend.
Maybe you need to ask Robbie Fowler that.
And they didn't get married until after he applied for the Euro MP job. Because we knew that Bob hadn't invited him, and therefore the director's box would not, and the dinner, the lunch, would be a no-go area, she just let rip. And the language that came out of Sarah's mouth is totally unrepeatable.
No, go on, repeat.
No, I can't. I can't remember half of it because I was so stunned myself. It was so much, though, that...
It just came from nowhere.
It came from absolutely nowhere. I mean, she just exploded.
A couple of glasses of wine first, maybe?
No. This was totally from the heart.
Right.
Poor Sam was stood there with his mouth open. He was absolutely staggered at what he was hearing. So much so that the police actually cleared us all out of the car park because they thought there was going to be a riot. And I had to phone Jimmy Case and ask him if he could persuade the police to allow me to bring the trophy onto the coach when it arrived, to be able to present it, because because of the outburst of one of our fellow fans.
And what was Bellotti's reaction to all this then?
Oh, it was a stupid grin, as usual.
Oh, right.
And he went in with, I think the police had to potentially sort of pretend to escort him in. And then, of course, he walked into the lunch and he was thrown out.
Good.
But that was the time, I think, when the worm turned, because from then on, Sarah was taken very, very seriously.
The thing is, there was that fire in her belly, which, like I say, you were surprised at, although you'd been given inklings as to what she could do. Paul Samra standing there, you know.
Absolutely wide-eyed. He just could not believe what he just heard. But we were then, all of us were then taken seriously, and we were then all heavily involved from that moment on.
But did you know it was that fire that drove her? I mean, if that fire could come out, was that fire that drove her, or was it, again, someone who saw solace? I know you're talking about her in terms of being a good Christian and taking heart and solace from that, but was it sort of pure rage and injustice?
It was rage that somebody was doing something to her football club.
Yeah.
Which she'd loved since she was very, very,
very
young.
She's got a very defined sense of right and wrong.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And was going and to this, do something
this,
about
this,
it.
And this oik was destroying our family, basically. Mm. That's what how she saw it. But as I say, the language that was used was unrepeatable. I don't think even Paul has got the bottle to do it. It was just everybody just sat back and thought, oh, come on then, join in, you know.
Yeah.
And the police were, I mean, the language she used was almost an arrestable offence on a public, you know, public highway.
Breach of the peace and all that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think because they knew what was coming, I think they were just very gentle and said, I think you'd better just move back a bit.
You've said your piece now, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really good. But from then on,
I think... Did they ever meet again, Sarah and Bellotti? Did they ever...
I think we tried not to.
Yeah.
I mean, we did have...
Unless she did clump him.
The best one was when we went to Rochdale. We were invited to take part in a quiz because BBC Five Live were doing a programme from Rochdale.
From Scotland.
From Scotland.
Yeah.
And we'd been invited in to take part in this quiz. And it was Halloween weekend. Mm-hmm. Or it was actually on a Tuesday night, but it was sort of around Halloween time. And when we got there, because this was Lizzie Kershaw,
yep.
And is it Rob Kershaw, her brother, who used to be, he is a Rochdale fan through
right.
and through.
Okay.
Lizzie was working for the BBC and had set this up, and it was going to be a quiz, you know, interclub between ourselves and Rochdale fans.
Yep.
When he got to hear about it, Mr. Bellotti, we were actually banned from going anywhere near the clubhouse. And although we had been given seats in the, you know, in the posh seats, we actually had to go over the far side and stand. And we saw him sitting in this stand, surrounded by stewards, on his lonesome, in this stand that we should have been sitting in.
What a pathetic, dribbly little man.
But the fun then was how he was going to get out of there.
I think this is told in Build a Bonfire, isn't it?
Oh, yes. He came out in a laundry basket. Eventually. Because we just parked the coach in front of the team coach, and there was no way they were going to leave without, you know, we knew what was going on. And then there was a minibus from another group of fans who followed the team coach, and they went round and round and round about a few times before they allowed the thing to go. You know, and he wanted to know.
I do recall someone in Build a Bonfire saying, you know, is this what my... It's along the lines of, this is what my life has become. I'm going round and round a roundabout at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
Wondering what I'm ever going to do if I actually get hold of this bloke,
yeah.
and you know, we'll be arrested.
Yeah, quite. Absolutely.
This is the fire that had to drive us, because make no mistake, they'd have closed the club, they'd have destroyed
it.
Of
course,
it would have gone down
in a
mass of flames.
But there was this restraint that everybody showed.
Mm.
No matter how,
but dear God, they don't deserve it.
Right? No, but I mean, they did, and there was this was how we got everything done because there was restraint shown.
But driven by rage,
yeah.
driven by injustice.
Yeah, but they never went over the edge.
Mm.
And that's the whole point, that they never went over the edge, which is what commanded respect from everybody.
But this is the point, I think, you know, in what you're saying there, this is the point, again, I was making on the Raw last week, was that this was a scene that was set by you and Sarah. I think that people, you know, they come to appreciate this now, is that if it would have been, I won't say if it was driven by blokes, that's not the right thing. But if it would have been
driven differently.
You two were the anchor by which the entire sort of setup was, you know, it's whatever we want to do, you just think, well, is this going to be appropriate for the people who are running this? And it's obviously not just you two, and there were the likes of Paul Sammer and Tim Carter
and Adrian Newnham.
And Adrian Newnham.
Well, we had Caroline, Adrian's wife at the time.
Yeah.
She was one of the, not rebels, but, you know, we had a lot of female help.
Mm.
It wasn't just the two of us. There was a group. So we all worked together.
Mm.
But it did, I think it was the fact that we were able to quell the testosterone a bit.
Yes.
By not letting people go overboard. And that they began to realise that they were actually having a hell of a lot more fun doing it that way.
But the point is that because hardly anyone else saw Sarah's rant at Bellotti in the Walsall car park, people didn't necessarily realise.
Oh no, they still
what
didn't.
A Rottweiler she could be.
No, they still didn't take it. They didn't take it.
They still see her as this sort of big, fluffy.
Yeah.
You know, sort of.
Yeah.
Bobble hat.
Yeah.
You know, with, you know, and all those sort of cliches that those entail.
Actually, going back to that Rochdale game.
Yeah.
The quiz was actually held on the pitch at half time, and Sarah went out onto the pitch wearing her witch's hat and a Satan's trident, she was carrying.
Mm.
And a cape, and Tim was there. This the pictures, the book of what's it called, More Than 90 Minutes, which was the photographic evidence of everything that we did.
Yes.
There's a picture of her in her witch's hat, and Tim in his bobble hat, which he's thoroughly ashamed of.
Looks good now.
It looks brilliant now. You look at it and you think, yeah, absolutely. That was another fun day, really.
So we spent 15 years campaigning. We collectively as fans spent 15 years campaigning, from getting Archer and Bellotti out to getting the club back, to getting back to Brighton, to getting the new stadium. And you guys and Sarah was very much at the heart of all this. So not so much obviously driven by rage, because eventually Archer and Bellotti did go, and they were sort of certainly Bellotti was unceremoniously booted out.
Mm.
Good riddance to him. You know, Bath is a lovely city. Christ alone knows what those people see in him, because, you know, it's...
Well, he's conned them like he conned us.
Well, quite. I love going down there, but it's knowing full well there's that sort of...
There's a sleeping policeman. You're allowed to reverse if you do... don't, if you miss the first time.
Absolutely. So, you've gone from, you know, driven by rage, but what was it that kept Sarah... Well, you can talk how you were, but what is it that kept Sarah going for... you know, the rest of those 15 years? Because she was, again, the epicenter of all this, wasn't she?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was then, during all of this drama, that, of course, he cancelled all the coaches. Mm-hmm. People had paid for coach seats. And then unceremoniously, he didn't pay the bus company. So when they turned up on the Saturday morning for a coach to go somewhere, there wasn't a coach. It did happen when we were going to Fulham.
Right.
And I got wind of it through a member of the Albion staff who phoned me and said, you might have a problem in the morning.
Yes.
And I managed to beg, borrow and steal a single-decker bus, which took us to Fulham. And
is this the one where we marched from Victoria to...
No, that was another one. Oh, okay, that was right. Another occasion. Oh, okay, yeah. And Fulham, again, was involved. And on the way back, it was when Des Lynam was running the 606. And on the way back, I phoned in to tell him what had happened and that the fact that, you know, these evil people had actually taken money from our fans, but had...
not put on the service.
No, you know, in basically... broke the rules and the coach had been cancelled. In the meantime, Archer phoned in as well. And so Des, being the Brighton fan that he is, asked him a few poignant questions. And he said, well, they're only a bunch of Southern softies. They won't notice it's missing when it's gone. And that kind of enraged everybody. And I think that just put the lead in the pencil, basically. Mm-hmm. Nobody was going to sit back and let it happen. So whatever was going, whatever, we were all involved in... Somehow we got co-opted ourselves onto every campaign committee that was going because we wanted to be involved. You know, Sarah lived alone. It was great social company for her, apart from anything else. I didn't. I was, you know, I'd moved in with John by then and I got all sorts of other things I could have been doing. But it became fun. But
John understood that.
Oh,
didn't
gosh,
he?
Yes. Yeah. He's a Brighton fan. Mm. Yeah. But we had so much fun planning it. This is the point.
The thing is, you were given it, you yourself had a, well, you and Sarah, you had a sense of purpose. It wasn't, you make it sound as though it was never a chore, even though we know it's campaigning. You even till such time as the stadium opened in 2011, you weren't sure that this was going to end successfully.
Well, no, we never were. Mm. You know, we got the planning permission and then it was sort of snatched away from us.
Yeah.
But we never stopped until we actually moved into that stadium, and then both of us burst into tears as we walked to our seats.
Well, of course, but I mean, my point was going to be was, I mean, someone like Attila, he said, you know, all I want to do now is just stop campaigning, just worry about us, you know, worry about the team. Which, you know, sorry, be careful what you wish for this season. But
yeah,
wasn't there a time where you think, God, I've spent the last 15 years campaigning. You can either go to one of two ways. One, I'm sick of this. Or two, I now miss this.
Well, we actually said, what the hell are we going to do with ourselves when the stadium is open?
Because it's job done.
So that was job done. So then we took on the homophobia campaign,
mm-hmm.
which was something else that was pretty close to both our hearts to stop the abuse that we were getting.
How much do you get to hear?
A lot. Well, no, I say a lot. For 25 years, we did hear an awful lot. And that was another thing that really Sarah led, and I was pleased to follow like a sheep, because campaigns like that, you can't do alone. You've got to have company to do it, because otherwise you're just banging your head against a brick wall. And we took it to our conferences, our football supporter conferences every year, and everybody promised they would do something and that they would get this done and they would get that done. And eventually it was included on ground regulations, but of course who the hell ever stands outside a turnstile reading all these, you know, they don't. Mm. It's like most people don't realise you're not supposed to take a camera into a ground. Well, everybody's got a phone now that has a camera on it. But we just went on and on and on and on. And it was... Around just before we moved into the Amex, we had contact with GFSN, the Gay Football Supporters Network, who had been asked by the government to see what could be done because it had been raised in Parliament. And the government asked GFSN if they could do something to help us. They contacted us and we thought, thank the Lord, there's somebody who's out there is listening.
Mm.
So we met with them on numerous occasions. And the campaign took off. And as a result of that, people are now understanding that it's not banter anymore. That was, we all got this nonsense riposte from all the clubs and the stewards. Well, it's only banter. But you ask, if you change the word gay to colour, you'd be thrown out the ground. Mm. Would you say those words that they're saying to your granny, to your next door neighbour? No. So therefore, it's abuse or intent to abuse.
So what was Sarah's role in that?
Well, she led it, basically. And between us, we recorded every chant that we heard and every action that was taken by the stewards and all the police, because the police laughed. They thought it was funny until it was pointed out to them. And until we were at Leicester and the worst one of all, I think that we'd heard anywhere. Darren Balkan was up in the police box. His jaw hit the ground because he couldn't believe nobody was doing anything. And that was the one that really tipped the balance. And then we got the police on side, and eventually we issued this report. And at in fact, if you look on the front page of our Supporters Club website, there's a lovely picture of Sarah, and she's actually holding the report when we were on our way to Forest. The following day, because we had BBC cameras with us, and they were filming and listening to what was being said, sadly, it went out on Easter Monday morning when very few people are watching daybreak. On a, you know, Easter Monday. But it got enough people watching to sort of sit back and say, whoops, something's happening here. The report landed on the FA's desk, on the government's desk, on the club's desk. Every club was sent a copy. And the broadsheet newspapers. Wasn't any point in giving it to the comic papers because they wouldn't have treated it with the respect that it needed. And since then, we can probably count now on one hand the number of chants that we've heard. And it is so limited that it's usually half a dozen people who think they'll try it on. And they are actually self-policed. A lot of fans are now filming their own fans and going to the stewards and saying, these people, could you please get rid of them?
And somewhere down the line, she got to know Graham Lasseau in all this.
Well, because Graham chaired the meetings that we go to up at the FA. And he was extremely... Well, since he heard that she was unwell, and the first thing he did was say, I've got to go and see her. And he came down in the middle of November to see her, fortunately, before things got sort of nasty for her. And he wanted to come to the funeral, and sadly he can't. He's out of the country, I think. But it was great to have people of his ilk supporting what we were doing and giving us concrete and sensible things to do. As I say, since the report was issued and since we've been having these regular meetings with the FA, there's very, very little chanting now. There's a few brain-dead idiots, but then it took 25 years for racism to get to where it is now. So, you know, three years down the line is really not a huge leap yet. But, I mean, we're getting there. It's education. This is all we're asking. And Sarah particularly was so keen that people could understand. Because one thing that we discovered was that people don't understand what homophobia is. They think it's homeopathy. It's a big word and they don't know what it means. If you say anti-gay chanting, they'll understand. And that was where we had to try to persuade the powers that be that that would be a good idea, is to teach people, especially when you're talking to sort of the teens and 20s who've been taught by their dads that it was fun to bait. We worked out when it all started. It's way, way back when there was a young kiddie who was abducted from the street, and he was found up on the up on the Devil's Dyke. And the Sun, in their inimitable wisdom, and we always know their headlines are great, said that one in four individuals in Brighton was gay. Well, that was, you know, fuel to every football fan that turned up ever since. So that was when it all started. But thankfully, with Sarah...
Sarah wrote this national report, which has now been...
Yeah, she was leading this, now, which is pretty much now the blueprint. All the police forces have got copies, and they... In fact, when we went up to Leeds for the first game of the... No, the last game of the season last year, Darren said he walked into the police box and he was sort of watching, and somebody's sitting there reading it, one of the officers. So they're taking notice. And as I say, this is all down to Sarah, bless her. I mean, she led it, and I was willing and happy to follow, because it's not something she could have done on her own. We got a lot of accusations, quite naturally. But it was the fact that it was two straight girls were doing it that... people did sit up and take notice. It wasn't sort of bleating, because I'm offended. We were angry that we were offended for the guy who might be gay, who's standing next to me.
Sure.
Because, you know, the argument is, why haven't we got any gay players? I don't care. It's not it's irrelevant. Mm. As long as they wear the shirt with the pride that I expect them.
Yeah, to homophobes, it is relevant somehow.
I don't understand why.
Yeah, quite.
I do not understand why, because we're all football fans. Because they're also trying to parcel us up and say, well, gay people can stand in an area together. You don't...
What?
You don't corral coloured people. Yeah, you don't
people
corral Jewish people.
Or,
that's right.
You know, green
I mean,
socks
how ridiculous.
Or,
we're all football fans. Mm. And as such, we want to be football fans. And that's all we are. And that was Sarah's argument, that, you know... That, there is no difference. We're all football fans and should not be abused by idiots.
So a few months ago, Sarah was complaining of headaches, and she went to the doctor and eventually got a diagnosis, probably with not a huge amount of help, as I understand it, from her GP.
Well, we've discovered since that, to basically take the pressure off the GP, that had they diagnosed it in February when she first started feeling really dizzy, it would have made no difference. Mm. So we, to some degree, are happy that it did not wait. You know, it was October before she was diagnosed.
Sure.
Because at least we had the summer to be able to talk to her.
Mm. Otherwise, she'd have just been in a hospital anyway.
She'd have probably been in a hospital and would have deteriorated, I think, quicker. It was a determination. I mean, she came with me to conference in July. She came to the Southampton friendly, and that was it. That was the last time she left the house, sort of without somebody picking her up. We did go to another meeting, but by and large, it was from August onwards that she was very poorly.
So there was a group of us that got wind of her of how bad it had gotten, and the fact that she wasn't going to get better. I think it was we were on our way to Spurs, and
that's right. That was
the
day.
Messages.
Yeah, that was the day she was told that it was terminal.
We got a few messages, and. And you've said there's, like I say, Terry Connor has been by and Graham Lasso has been by. Mm. And there's been quite a few well wishes.
Certainly. Mickey Adams has phoned her three or four times. She's had messages from Charlie Oatway, from Gary Hart, you know, sort of from past players and managers have been very, very kind.
Charlie Oatway's response was kind of suitably robust, wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Very
it was
Charlie
it was
Oatway.
A Charlie, yeah. Yes. I mean, if you didn't know who had sent it, you'd know by looking at the four words. Mm. You know, he's desperately sad because we were on his committee, his testimonial committee, mm-hmm. and of course that all went belly up. Mm. You know, again, we're on a committee.
So, over these 30 plus years that you've known Sarah, what has she meant to you?
She's been my best friend. I was never allowed a friend as a child because of domestic circumstances. My father didn't tell me till I was 18 that the woman who brought me up was my stepmother, who I hated with a passion. So the fact that I found a friend, I wasn't going to let her go that easily because, you know, most people at boarding school go home and stay with friends at school, you know, with the exchange home visits. But no, I never was allowed to do that. And it was someone that I could relate to. I got her into bird watching because she wanted to go out for walks. When she went through a phase where she lost a heck of a lot of weight 5 or 6 years ago, and she said, "Will you come for a walk?" Well, I don't need a second request. Gave her a pair of binoculars, and off we went. And she got hooked on bird watching, and then she realised that was something else she could do on her own because she didn't need. You know, she found out that bird watchers in general, if you ask somebody what's that, they will tell you. You know, they're very helpful. They don't sort of look and say, "Oh, well, why don't you know?" So she used to take herself off to Pulborough Brooks quite frequently. And we did do a lot of walking together, in actual fact. The so-called riot in Portugal, where the police refused to allow taxis to come to the ground to pick up the supporters after the referee had picked up the ball and gone home. Mm. She walked all the way back from the ground, which was about 5 miles out of town, in pitch darkness, walking along this road.
Heaven forfend anyone that gets in her way.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, it was great. Where else did we have? Well, of course, when I did the walk from Gillingham back to Brighton, the protest, she was as our sort of wingman. She was the support car. Mm-hmm. And when we got to Mayfield, pretty much, we thought it was time to stop. We stopped in a lay-by beside a little chef. We were collected by Nigel, who was the bridge notices, you know, when we're doing the support.
Nigel Summers,
yeah. He was living in Burgess Hill at the time, and there were about a dozen of us all pitched up in his on his floor, do it like sardines in a can, you know, head feet. We actually discovered that having been sitting in that lay-by for goodness knows how long, that little chef was broken into that night, but it wasn't us. Honest, Gov, it wasn't. Yeah. And so that she was involved heavily in that. One of the funniest memories, I think, was this again. We all seem to get involved with battles and wars. The Battle of Longford.
Oh, you were there at that?
Oh, we were at that, yes. Right. We thoroughly enjoyed
that. Did you have to run away very quickly?
No. I mean, most of what was going on was on the pitch.
Yeah. The team maintained that they had to get away a bit sharp.
Yes, they did. And unfortunately, it caused us a big problem because at the time they were rebuilding Longford's stadium, for want of a better word. Mm. And the only toilet in the ground was in the players' changing room. And so we'd been allowed to use it before the game, but not after. Right. Not once all this happened. And, of course, it all called off again at half-time. So what were we going to do with ourselves? So we all piled back into our people carrier, went into Longford itself, into the Longford Hotel, and gate-crashed a wedding reception.
Fantastic.
Which was brilliant. We had a lot of fun, a lot of...
drink.
Drink.
And Sarah, we get to realise, yeah?
Yeah, Sarah and Adrian Newnham did... probably half an hour's worth of Grease songs. You're the one that I want.
And no one videoed it?
No.
Oh, dear.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And I think she had so much fun that night. As we did, I'd actually forgotten about it, and it was Adrian who reminded me of it, that was a side that very, very few Brighton fans would have ever seen.
Fantastic. I think she'd have made a good Olivia Newton-John.
Yeah. But the two of them, it was a tremendous show.
In order to answer this, it sounds like you would pat yourself on the back, seeing as you were seen as a double team. How much do you think the Brighton fans owe to Sarah Watts?
A hell of a lot, because a lot of people followed when they saw women doing protesting and all this sort of thing. We had a lot of people just decide, you know, particularly the older ladies. Mm-hmm. Somehow decided that it was good, and they brought along their young children. But there was a great many of the almost retired people realised that it was actually okay to protest. Mm. It was great fun then that, you know, we could sort of look around and in fact, Brighton actually has a huge female contingent. Mm. When we go to away games, you look around and there's a hell of a lot of women.
There are, with a lot of away fans that come to the Amex as well, anyway.
Mm, but we seem to take probably a larger proportion than a lot do.
To be honest, I hadn't considered it, but yeah. I'm going to look out for that in the future and see if that's maybe
there's an awful lot.
Okay, yeah.
Generally in groups, because they all travel in groups. Mm-hmm. I've got about six or seven of us on the coach regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a case of... people realised that it was okay to protest because it was not the sort of testosterone-ridden...
mayhem.
Well, you know, the illogical way of doing things. Rather, this was a little bit of calm. The storm would happen, but it would be under control. And I think that's what people enjoyed about the protesting, that they knew that they could now do it. They could do it and they could get away with it, and probably they had the time of their lives because they, as youngsters, would never have been allowed that sort of freedom. So, you know, I'm proud that she was a friend of mine, and I'm so proud that she was there.